Hello, it's time to read from the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, January 23rd, 2021. My name is John Reif, and here's a look at what I'll be reading today. I'll start with the weather and the mini editorial, then I'll move to the stories on the front page, then to the inside pages for more stories of local interest. At the 20-minute mark, I'll read the opinion page, any letters to the editor. At the 30-minute mark, the obituaries, followed by sports and more feature stories as time allows, wrapping up with Dear Abby. For the forecast today, cloudy skies, afternoon snow showers, a high of 29 degrees, winds out of the southeast at 8 to 16 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy, a little snow here and there, a low down to 21, and winds dropping down from the east at 4 to 8 miles an hour. For Sunday, a thick cloud cover, some snow at night, a high of 29 degrees and a low of 17 degrees, winds north-northeast at 7 to 14. On Monday, cloudy skies, a high of 24 degrees, winds northeast 8 to 16 miles an hour. Cloudy on Monday night, a low of 10, and cloudy on Tuesday, a high of 25 degrees. On Tuesday night, low of 16, and then cloudy on Wednesday with a morning flurry possible, and a high of 31 degrees, a little bit better for the weather on Wednesday. Taking a look at the mini editorial today, this is by David Adkins of Sioux City, and it reads as follows. I would like to thank President Trump for pushing the creation of the COVID vaccine. He accomplished in 8 months what the experts claimed would take 2 to 3 years. And again, that from David Adkins of Sioux City. Front page story, Biden takes virus aid action. Joe Biden's ambitious opening bid, his $1.9 trillion American Rescue Economic Package, will test the new president's relationship with Congress and force a crucial choice between his policy vision and a desire for bipartisan unity. Biden became president this week with the pandemic having already forced Congress to approve $4 trillion in aid, including $900 billion just last month. And those efforts have politically exhausted Republican lawmakers, particularly conservatives who are panning the new proposal as an expensive, unworkable liberal wish list. Yet Democrats, now with control of the House, Senate, and White House, want the new president to deliver even more sweeping aid and economic change. On Friday, Biden took a few beginning steps, signing executive orders at the White House. But he also declared a need to do much more and quickly, saying that even with decisive action, the nation is unlikely to stop the pandemic in the next several months, and well over 600,000 could die. The bottom line is this, we are in a national emergency. We need to act like we are in a national emergency, he said. So we've got to move with everything we got. We've got to do it together. I don't believe Democrats or Republicans are going hungry and losing jobs. I believe Americans are going hungry and losing jobs. The limits of what Biden can achieve on his own without Congress was evident in the pair of executive orders he signed Friday. The orders would increase food aid, protect job seekers on unemployment, make it easier to obtain government aid, and clear a path for federal workers and contractors to get a $15 an hour minimum wage. Brian Deese, director of the White House National Economic Council, called the orders a, quoting here, critical lifeline rather than a substitute for the larger aid package that he said must be passed quickly. All of this leaves Biden with a decision that his team has avoided publicly addressing, which is the trade-off ahead for the new president. He can try to appease Republicans, particularly those in the Senate whose votes will be needed for bipartisan passage, by sacrificing some of his agenda. Or he can try to pass as much of his proposal as possible on a party-line basis. Well aware of all that, Biden is a seasoned veteran of Capitol Hill deal-making and has assembled a White House staff already working privately with lawmakers and their aides to test the bounds of bipartisanship. On Sunday, Deese will meet privately with a bipartisan group of 16 senators, mostly centrists, who were among those instrumental in crafting and delivering the most recent round of COVID aid. The ability to win over that coalition, led by Senators Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, and Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, will be central to any path, a test run for working with Congress on a bipartisan basis. Any new COVID relief package must be focused on the public health and economic crisis at hand, Collins said in a Friday statement. She said she looks forward to hearing more about the administration's specific proposals to assist with vaccine distribution, help keep our families and communities safe, and combat this virus so our country can return to normal. The Biden team's approach could set the tenor for the rest of his presidency, showing whether he can provide the partisan healing that he called for in Wednesday's inaugural address, and whether the narrowly split Senate will prove a trusted partner or a roadblock in the White House agenda. The ball will be in Biden's court to decide how much he is going to insist on and at what cost, said William Galston, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. As the old saw goes, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. Most economists believe the United States can rebound with strength once people are vaccinated from the coronavirus, but the situation is still dire as the disease has closed businesses and schools. Nearly 10 million jobs have been lost since last February, and nearly 30 million households lack secure access to food. One of the orders that Biden signed Friday asks the Agriculture Department to consider adjusting the rules for food assistance so the government could be obligated to provide more money to the hungry. It also makes it easier for people to claim payments and benefits provided by the government. In addition, it would create a guarantee that workers could still collect unemployment benefits if they refuse to take jobs that could jeopardize their health. Biden's second executive order would restore some union bargaining rights revoked by the Trump administration, protect the civil service system from changes made in the Trump years, and promote a $15 an hour minimum wage for all federal workers. But neither of the orders would have the transformative potential of another round of Congress-passed stimulus. Biden's plan includes $400 billion for national vaccinations and school reopenings, as well as direct payments of $1,400 to eligible adults, state and local government aid, and expanded tax credits for children and child care. Pushing for both bipartisanship and the full contents of their stimulus plan, Biden officials have signaled that the price tag and contents could change, but have declined to provide any specifics. The final package may not look exactly like the package that he's proposed. That's okay. That's how the legislative process should work, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Friday. On the front page, it shows an inset picture of President Joe Biden as he delivers remarks on the economy Friday in the state dining room of the White House. In the inset picture in the front page, it shows Freeze Fest Run. It shows Briarcliff students Megan O'Gara and Frederico Acosta and Teresa Schulte and Nicole Rayner playing a real-life version of Hungry Hungry Hippos at Briarcliff's Freeze Fest in Sioux City on Friday. Just showing a fun little picture in the middle there. No story with that. Next story from the front page, Monson may fill temp vacancy. Supervisors look to fill Taylor's seat. This by Brett Hayworth and Dateline Sioux City. The Woodbury County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday will consider appointing a former supervisor to a position that has been created by the lengthy overseas military deployment of Supervisor Jeremy Taylor. The supervisors, in their most recent meeting on January 19th, debated whether the position needed to be filled, with no decision being made. The upcoming Tuesday board meeting agenda shows Supervisor Matthew Ung recommended a vote on an appointment of former Supervisor Mark Monson. We've talked amongst ourselves about not filling it. At least three names were put out there, including Monson, Board Chairman Rocky DeWitt said Friday. In the January 12th meeting in which Taylor announced his upcoming deployment, Supervisor Keith Radig said the four supervisors should, quoting here, play it by ear and see over the next 2 to 3 months if they see the necessity of appointing someone in Taylor's absence. In recommending Monson, Ung said, quoting here, going through another stint of several months without a fifth supervisor is not ideal nor practical. The appointment will require a majority vote of the four remaining supervisors, which means three votes. Monson, 75, in 2020 retired from the position of executive director of Missouri River Historical Development, Inc. He also served 3 4-year terms on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors before unsuccessfully running for re-election in 2016. In the Democrat primary that year, he lost to former supervisor Marty Potterbaum, who in the campaign cited Monson's support for policies proposed by Republicans on the board. Quoting here, "It is a fact that the transparency and fiscal reforms I supported in my first years on the board would not have happened without Monson's vote. He walked the talk, reaching across the aisle to make Woodbury County better despite the consequences, and I believe this Republican board should reach back." Unquote from Matthew Ung. In the 2016 general election, Monson ran as an independent candidate as Potterbaum defeated Monson and Republican nominee Brian Miller. In November, Potterbaum lost his re-election bid to Taylor. Taylor will depart for the Middle East for up to 400 days in a deployment send-off event Sunday in his role as a chaplain for the 734th RSG Iowa Army National Guard. Beyond being a supervisor and holding his guard position, Taylor, 42, a former teacher, is the energy and environmental specialist for the Sioux City School District. The school district and county, following state and federal laws, will pay his salary for 30 days once his deployment starts. Taylor's combined annual salary with the two government entities is over $119,000. That's $83,525 with the school district and $36,050 as a supervisor, according to public records. Once National Guard members are called to active duty, they switch from the typical periodic drill pay to additional compensation by virtue of working full-time. Taylor enlisted as an intelligence analyst in 2009 and was commissioned as an officer and chaplain candidate in 2012. He currently holds the rank of major in the 734th Regional Support Group headquartered in Camp Dodge, Iowa. Last story on the front page, some sad news, Kingsley to lose grocery store. Chet's largest small-town grocer to fall victim to competition, the Stateline Kingsley. The convenience of having a grocery store in town is not lost on Scott Bailey. On more than one occasion, the Kingsley Pearson School superintendent has made the quick trip downtown to Chet's Foods to pick up something he has run out of. "It was so nice. If you needed something for a recipe, I could just run down there and be back home in 5 minutes," Bailey said. Unfortunately for Bailey and other Kingsley residents, they will soon experience what so many others who live in small towns have gone through. Chet's Foods is scheduled to close on January 31st, leaving Kingsley without a grocery store. The nearest grocery stores are all roughly a half-hour drive away. "We hate to lose any business in town," Bailey said. "The closing of the grocery store is a big staple in the community." Fewer small towns nowadays have a grocery store. Dwindling populations mean fewer customers. Residents who work in larger cities nearby purchase their groceries there. Discount retailers such as Dollar General, which sells some food items but not fresh meat or produce, also have expanded into rural areas, attracting customers with low prices that a small grocer can't match. Chet and Linda Davis opened in their store in 1978 after buying out another grocer in the same location. They declined to be interviewed, but have said in the past that they realized their store's importance to Kingsley. They also said it was getting tougher to compete with Dollar General, which opened a store in Kingsley nearly a year ago. The opening of a Dollar General in nearby Mauville in 2016 was a big reason they closed their grocery store there. "Once you lose your grocery store in town, it's going to hurt the whole economy," Chet Davis told the Journal in 2019. He's right, of course. Losing a grocery store doesn't just affect the residents who shop there, it affects other businesses in town. A trip to the grocery store might also include a stop at the pharmacy or hardware store, helping boost the bottom line of those business owners. Anything that brings people to Kingsley, they shop the town," Kingsley Mayor Rick Bull said. "The loss of Chet's will be tough on this Plymouth County community of some 1,400 people, especially for older residents who have a harder time driving to Sioux City or Lamar's for groceries." Bull said he can't blame the Davises for their retirement decision. "Chet's 75. I don't begrudge him. He's put his time in," Bull said. Bull said he's confident the Main Street store won't be empty for long. "We do have some possible interest in someone buying the store," he said. "I think we'll have someone coming in. I'm really positive we'll have someone step into it." Any potential store owner, Bull said, should know that Kingsley residents will support it. "Kingsley's always been pretty supportive of businesses here," he said. "I'm hoping for the best. Mayors of other towns that lost their grocery stores probably did too. That hope was lost for many of them. The former grocery stores in their towns remain vacant, coolers and shelving sold and removed long ago. Hopefully, people realize how important the grocery store is to their community," Chet Davis told the Journal for a story last February. "There's no doubt they do, whether it was working with the school to supply concession stands or giving residents who wish to avoid large crowds because of the ongoing pandemic a less crowded shopping option. Chet's provided a valuable service to the community. Where we're at, it's pretty important to have a store," Bull said, repeating his belief that the situation will work out in Kingsley's favor. "The grocery store shelves may soon be empty, but there's plenty of optimism in stock." It shows a picture on the front page of Megan Plendle walking out of Chet's Foods with her grocery Saturday in Kingsley. The store is scheduled to close on January 31st, leaving the Plymouth County community without a grocery store. Moving to page A2, good news here, zero new COVID cases in Sioux City schools. This by Brad Hayworth, Dateline Sioux City. The Sioux City School District officials had expressed hope that there would not be an uptick of COVID-19 positive cases among students and employees following the long holiday break, and that's exactly what has happened, with only two cases reported over 3 weeks in January. There were zero cases reported for the week ended Friday, and there had been only one case in each of the first 2 weeks of January since classes resumed. Additionally, there are fewer students lately out of school in precautionary quarantine. In order to reduce the virus impact, district workers continue taking steps such as extensive cleaning and sanitizing places that are heavily used in buildings, and face masks are required in buildings. Virus-positive tests are also dropping in the metro and surrounding Siouxland counties. As of Friday, the number of positive cases in Woodbury County was just under 13,100, a total that was about 140 more than 1 week ago. There have been 181 deaths from COVID-19 in Woodbury County, with the number rising by 2 from Thursday and 6 having occurred over the last 7 days. There were 6 deaths reported in Siouxland on Friday, with one in Clay County, South Dakota, where the total rose to 14. In Northwest Iowa, the 5 deaths included the 2 in Woodbury County, 1 in Osceola County, which now has 11 deaths, 1 in Plymouth County, where the total rose to 70, and 1 in Monona County, where there have now been 18 deaths. A virus vaccine first became available in Siouxland in December. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported 4,111 coronavirus vaccine doses had been administered to Woodbury County residents. The second highest total in Northwest Iowa was 1,480 doses in Sioux County. Also on Friday, a total of 29 patients who tested positive for COVID-19 were hospitalized at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center or Unity Point Health St. Luke's, according to the Siouxland Public Health Department. Of those patients, 21 were hospitalized for treatment of the virus, a number that had decreased by 12 since Tuesday. The school district in early September began the Friday practice of releasing the number of positive cases determined within the district over each week. The pandemic impact trend in the Sioux City district lessened in December. The December 18th report, the last report prior to the break, showed 4 students and 6 employees tested positive, while the numbers the prior week had 12 students testing positive. Classes had been in a hybrid version of learning for the first 2 weeks of January in a decision made by the Sioux City School Board on December 14th to lessen any impact of pupils and staff from mingling with friends and family over the holiday break. That setup ended January 14th. From early October to December, more than 24 class sections converted from in-person to virtual learning for 2 weeks, as higher virus numbers showed up in varying schools. One other statistical recap showed the number of students out of a pupil population of just under 15,000 who were out of buildings while quarantining due to the virus. The most recent number was for Tuesday, when 192 students were absent via quarantine, while a prior amount 1 week ago was 240 as compared to 265 for the first week of January. There were 505 students absent via quarantine on December 22nd and 406 on December 15th. Those totals can vary greatly from day to day as pupils begin or end quarantines of roughly 10 days. The release noted that for each positive case reported, contact tracing is done in conjunction with Siouxland District Health Department. Individuals who test positive, as well as any individuals identified as close contacts, are directed to self-isolate or self-quarantine and take other appropriate measures in accordance with state and public health guidance. Looking at the inset graphs of coronavirus cases, the number of presumptive cases of coronavirus continues to rise in Siouxland states. South Dakota has 106,716, Nebraska has 185,346, and Iowa with 310,943. Breaking it down by county, Yankton County in South Dakota, 2,706 cases, 27 deaths. Union County, 1,824 cases, 36 deaths. Clay County, 1,739 cases and 14 deaths. Cedar County in Nebraska has 794 cases, 10 deaths. Dixon, 585 cases, 8 deaths. Wayne County, 982 cases, 9 deaths. Thurston County, 1,010 cases and 9 deaths. And Dakota County, 3,762 cases and 67 deaths. In Iowa, Lyon County, 1,379 cases, 33 deaths. Osceola, 645 cases, 11 deaths. Dickinson, 1,881 cases and 29 deaths. Sioux County at 4,589 cases, 57 deaths. O'Brien at 1,706 cases, 54 deaths. Clay County, 1,711 and 21 deaths. Plymouth County at 3,522 cases and 70 deaths. Cherokee County, 1,397 cases, 27 deaths. Buena Vista, 3,953 cases, 30 deaths. Ida County, 756 with 30 deaths. Sac, 1,115 cases, 19 deaths. Monona, 667 cases, 18 deaths. Crawford at 2,336 cases, 24 deaths. And Woodbury County, 13,080 cases and 181 deaths. Moving now to the opinion page, and today's Other Voices is from the Lincoln Journal Star, and the title is Make Cocktails to Go Permanently Legal in Nebraska. The Cocktails to Go movement, which began and continues as a way to help struggling restaurants stay afloat during the COVID-19 pandemic, looks like it might be heading toward becoming permanent. LB 295, introduced last week by Lincoln Senator Anna Wishart, seeks to repeal the prohibition on the sale of alcoholic liquor to a person within a motor vehicle. It would reinforce Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts' emergency mandate that was put in place last spring, allowing restaurants to sell drinks to patrons making takeout food orders. Ricketts was wise to institute the emergency order early in the pandemic and keep it in place until Nebraska is back to normal. Wishart's proposal is the next step as Nebraska begins rebuilding an economy that was greatly hurt by the pandemic. Nebraska isn't alone. 31 other states that have instituted temporary laws that legalize curbside alcohol service to help a struggling service industry, and many of them are trying to extend them long past the pandemic. It's hard to disagree with the logic, and harder to put the toothpaste back into the tube. It would be impossible, not to mention hypothetical, to cite safety issues for suddenly reverting back to previous pre-virus laws. Of course, we'd suggest that protocols remain in place that require checking the identification of anyone placing a curbside order to ensure that the underage are not provided with an opportunity to acquire alcohol. We would be remiss to endorse any piece of legislation that makes it easier to drink and drive. Then again, this law does nothing of that sort. Most people are keenly aware that sneaking a sip on the way home isn't nearly as innocent as reaching into the bag for a French fry or two between the way home from the drive-thru. Capitalism has given everyone of age ample opportunities to drink and drive. There is no difference between chugging a purchase from a bottle tonight at a local liquor store and a sealed carton of margaritas from your favorite Mexican place. The open container laws already in place punish both equally. And it should be noted that restaurants have done a good job of sealing their drinks to go in containers that are not conducive to sampling or sipping by the driver. The statistics would back up that statement. Nebraska State Patrol statistics indicate that drunken driving arrests declined by nearly 24% from the end of March through December compared with the same time from a year ago. Of course, critics will contend that those statistics are skewed by the fact that fewer people were driving this year because of the pandemic. We care to believe that the vast majority of people abide by the laws in place, meaning Nebraskans won't abuse their ability to purchase to-go cocktails to take home. And again, that is from the Lincoln Journal Star, from Other Voices on the Opinion page. Moving back to page A2, some Nebraskans may face 4-month wait for the vaccine. This is by Grant Schulte and Dateline Lincoln. Nebraska residents who are younger than 65 years old and considered healthy may have to wait another 4 months to get the coronavirus vaccine based on current distributions to the state, officials said Friday. State health officials and Governor Pete Ricketts said they're currently receiving 94,000 vaccinations a month through the distribution chain administered by the federal government. Nebraska has already been vaccinating frontline healthcare workers and people with ties to long-term care facilities. Under the state's distribution plan, the next in line are an estimated 500,000 residents who are at least 65 years old or have a health condition that puts them at greater risk if they catch the virus. State officials predict that 75% of that group will get a vaccine, which translates into a 4-month wait for everyone else unless Nebraska starts receiving a larger number of vaccine shipments. Currently, the only two vaccines authorized for emergency use in the United States are produced by drug makers Pfizer and Moderna. Quoting here, if we get additional vaccines approved by the government, that will allow us to speed this process up, Pete Ricketts said during a news conference on the state's pandemic response. Nebraska's two largest public health districts encompassing Omaha and Lincoln will start vaccinating people 65 and older and those with health conditions during the first week of February, said Angie Ling, incident commander for the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services. 15 other health departments in rural parts of the state have already begun vaccinating that group because their populations are smaller, and two others are expected to start this week. Ling said residents will be able to get vaccinated at community health clinics, their local health care provider, or at pharmacies that carry the drugs. The state also plans to launch a registration website on January 29th, along with a hotline for people who don't have internet access. Some local governments have already established registration websites, but Ling said those will feed into the state's website to help determine when residents are eligible. State officials previously predicted that vaccinations would be available to the general public by April. Ricketts said Nebraska has been able to distribute vaccines through a network of hospitals and other health care providers, but is limited by the supply it receives each week. If there's more supply, we will find ways to get it into people's arms, he said. Ling said Pfizer and Moderna are working to increase their production, which would allow the state to quicken its pace. Nebraska had 421 people hospitalized with the virus as of Thursday evening, continuing a decline from the all-time high of 987 in mid-November, according to the state's online tracking portal. The state has confirmed 185,346 cases and 1,868 deaths since the pandemic began. Nearly 83% of those who have died were 65 or older. The state reported 864 new cases on Thursday, down from the peak numbers reached in mid-November. Next story, Iowa Democratic leader calls for GOP lawmaker to be punished for post. Iowa House Minority Leader Todd Pritchard has called on Speaker Pat Grassley to remove a committee chairman for what he called a series of false social media posts. Pritchard, Democrat from Charles City, wants Representative Dean Fisher, Republican from Montour, removed as chairman of the Environmental Protection Committee and stripped of all committee assignments because of comments Fisher made about election fraud and the January 6th attack on the Capitol, and because he has refused to apologize for his posts. Quoting here, Fisher must be held accountable for his actions, Pritchard said in a letter to Grassley. Grassley, however, said the minority leader was playing the exact partisan politics he hypothetically denounced in his remarks at the beginning of the session. Pritchard clearly believes that the right to free speech should only belong to those he agrees with, Grassley said. In social media posts, Fisher claimed there had been, quoting here, outright cheating, end quote, in Democratic-led states and cities. Referring to the Supreme Court refusing to overturn election results, Fisher said, quoting here, "We will survive. Remember, our side has the guns. The other side doesn't know which bathroom to use," end quote. Pritchard called on Fisher to apologize. Fisher refused and called questions about his posts a phony claim. I will not give it credence. Grassley gave no indication he would take action to punish Fisher. Instead, the speaker said House Republicans will focus on, quoting here, doing the job they were elected to do. With Republicans now representing part or all of 97 out of Iowa's 99 counties, Iowans made their voices heard unequivocally that they want more of the steady leadership shown by House Republicans and less of the partisan games and attacks from Democrats, Grassley said. It's not about left or right or Democrats versus Republicans, Pritchard said. As leaders in this state, we cannot remain silent and ignore the truth while promoting violence, he said. Healing the divisions in our country starts with leaders telling the truth and setting the right example for respect. Change starts with us. Next brief, South Dakota reports 11 more COVID-19 deaths. South Dakota health officials reported Friday that an additional 11 people have died from COVID-19 and 316 more people have tested positive for the virus. The figures bring the total number of deaths to 1,684 since the pandemic began. To date, 106,716 people have been infected in the state. Hospitalizations in the state continue to trend downward. On Friday, 177 people were hospitalized, including 37 in intensive care. The number of people hospitalized is 8 less than the day before. South Dakota health officials say 69,104 doses of the vaccine have been administered, an increase of 6,739 over the day before, the Argus Leader reported. The number of active infections increased by 12 to 4,090. It's time now for the obituary, starting with Kingsley, Iowa. Beverly Petekovich, that's Petekavich. Beverly Petekovich, 88 years old, passed away Tuesday, January 19th. Arrangements are pending with Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. From Littleton, Colorado, formerly Sioux City, on Sunday, January 10th, Jesse L. Trudell of Littleton, loving husband and father of 5 children and a proud grandfather, went to meet his Savior. He passed at home with his wife and his son Matthew attending. He was 71. A memorial service will be planned later this year in Sioux City to celebrate his life. Jesse was born October 12, 1949 in Sioux City. Jesse worked in the construction industry throughout the Midwest, providing services for residential and commercial projects. Jesse was outgoing. He loved playing pool and getting together with his family and friends. From Correctionville, Donna M. Hayes. Donna M. Hayes, 84 years old, of Correctionville, passed away on Saturday, January 16th at a local hospital. Services are pending at the Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Correctionville. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Correctionville is in charge of the arrangements as well. Online condolences may be made at nicholasdjensenfh.com. Donna Maxine Hayes was born July 2, 1936 in Correctionville to Lloyd and Marjorie Courtney Dunkelberger. Donna was united in marriage to Rudy Hayes on September 21, 1958 in Correctionville. They were blessed with 3 children. The family made their home in Correctionville, where Donna was a homemaker. Her greatest joy was found in her children, grandbabies, quilting, and her numerous friends. She also enjoyed wood carving, crocheting, and crafting. She was a member of the American Legion Auxiliary and volunteered with Meals on Wheels. She was a member of the Church of Christ in Correctionville. From Sioux City, William Bill Leverton, 78 years old of Sioux City. Mr. Leverton died Tuesday, January 19th at a local hospital after a courageous battle with cancer. Services will be held 11 a.m. Monday at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial will be in West Fork Township Cemetery in Climbing Hill. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, masks are required. William Ernest Leverton was born on March 19, 1942, in Sioux City, the son of Thomas and Ethel Johnston Leverton. Bill graduated from Central High School in 1960. On January 5, 1980, Bill was united in marriage to Sharon Carroll. Over the years, Bill worked for Klinger Construction Company. Bill enjoyed fishing, camping, and working crossword puzzles. He enjoyed being a small engine mechanic. He loved spending time with his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. From Davenport, Iowa, Lynn Broderson Cochran, C-O-C-H-R-A-N, Lynn Broderson Cochran of Davenport passed into the afterlife on Tuesday, January 12, 2021. A private service will be held today at Wirtz Funeral Home. A live stream will be held at facebook.com/weertsfuneral/@10:30 a.m. on 10:30 a.m. Online condolences may be made to the family by visiting her obituary at weertsfh.com. Lynn was born December 31st, 1968, to Ann Norcott and Hans V. Broderson, Jr. in Haywarden. She graduated from North High School in Sioux City. She received her B.A. in History, magna cum laude, from Coe College in Cedar Rapids in May of 1991. Lynn received her M.A. degree from the University of Notre Dame in Modern European History in August of 1992. Her Ph.D. in Education, Leadership and Policy Studies emphasis was granted from Iowa State University in 2008. She was a member of Phi Beta Kappa and a Mortar Board. On March 17, 2017, she was united in marriage to Douglas Cochran in Newton, Iowa. Lynn was a passionate professional who served community colleges and higher education for over 30 years. She served Western Iowa Tech Community College, Metropolitan Community College in Omaha, Central Lakes College in Brainerd, Minnesota, University of Wisconsin-Richland, North Iowa Area Community College in Mason City, Iowa State University Extension, and most recently as president of Scott Community College in Davenport. She loved the college, the students, faculty, and staff. Lynn was known for her innate skill to remember people's names. Students felt honored and humbled to have the college president greet them by name and express kind words of encouragement. She was never too busy to spend quality time with students, lend an ear to a faculty member, or mentor a rising professional. Friends would describe Lynn as a Renaissance woman with her many talents and widely varied interests. Lynn was equally comfortable presenting to business leaders, rolling up under a diesel engine, or rocking out in her Motorhead hoodie. She could quote you 16th century European history 1 minute and discuss the inner workings of a V8 engine the next. One of her favorite spots on campus was in the auto and diesel labs or climbing up to check out the new semi-trucks. She believed deeply in the value of career and technical education and in the importance of creating a skilled workforce for the community. Her ease in striking up a conversation assisted in creating new partnerships, raising dollars for the college, and moving initiatives forward. Her genuine interest in people, learning creatively, made her an exceptional leader. Her most cherished awards and honor came from recognitions bestowed by her students, including her 2020 Paragon Award for New College Presidents from the Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. When Lynn was busy working at the college or rocking out, she would often be found with her two miniature schnauzers, Lulu and Olaf, or helping to rescue other dogs. Lynn's impact will stand long past her time at the college and on this earth. She quietly gave a gift of making all that encountered her who feel to feel valued, and each left better understanding their own worth. Her mentorship, leadership, and example will live on in those who were fortunate enough to have crossed her path. Memorials in Lynn's name may be made to Scott Community College Foundation in Lynn's name in support of her student enrichment projects at eicc.edu/scfoundation or to WAGNTRAIN Terrier Rescue in Omaha, Wagon Train Terrier Rescue in Omaha at, let me spell it again, www.WAGNTRAINTERRIERRESCUE.com. From Ponca, Nebraska, Aubrey F. Aubrey Voss. Aubrey Voss, 69 years old, died Thursday, January 21st. Services will be private at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Ponca. Burial will be at Ponca City Cemetery. Public visitation will be January 24th from 2 to 5 p.m. Moore Funeral Home in Ponca is handling the arrangements. From South Sioux City, Abelardo C. Davila of South Sioux City, 77 years old, passed away Tuesday, January 19th. Services will be January 23rd at 12 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Homes in Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time. From Lamar's, Dorothy A. Ruland, R-U-H-L-A-N-D, of Lamar's, Dorothy Ruland, 82 years old, passed away Tuesday, January 21st. Services will be January 25th at 1 p.m. at All Saints Catholic Parish of St. Joseph Church in Lamar's. Private will be burial after the service, Calvary Cemetery in Lamar's. Visitation will be January 24th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the church. Masks and social distancing required. Arrangements with Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamar's. From Kingsley, Clarice M. Bainbridge of Kingsley, 89 years old, died Friday, January 22nd. Arrangements are pending with Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Moving on now to Sports East. Pair win 3 matches. And this is women's wrestling. Yareli Morales and Angelina Rasmussen started off strong Friday at the IWCOA Girls State Wrestling Tournament at Extreme Arena. Both East High School wrestlers won their first 3 matches to keep their tournament runs intact in Coralville, Iowa. Morales, ranked 7th at 106 pounds, recorded a bye and got 2 wins by fall. Morales' first match came against Cedar Falls' Hope Chiatello, and Morales pinned her in 48 seconds. Her second match ended sooner as Morales pinned Okoboji HMS Kira McCoy in 36 seconds. Rasmussen, meanwhile, had to wrestle 3 times on Friday in the 120-pound division. Her first match came against Decorah's Karina Tim, and the match ended with a pin at 5 minutes, 17 seconds. Rasmussen then pinned Chevelle Gifaller of Denver in 4 minutes, 28 seconds. Then in her third match, Rasmussen won by a 12-4 major decision over Rianne Holt of Williamsburg. West's Jasmine Murdoch wrestled 4 times on Friday in the 132 division. She won her first match with an 87-second pin over Sumner Fredericksburg's Cassandra Rich. Then Fort Dodge's Alexis Ross pinned Murdoch in 128 to put Murdoch in the consolation bracket. Murdoch bounced back to pin Iowa City's West's Yosefina Abwe in 151, but in round 3 of the consist, Ava McDermott of Dubuque pinned Wallet the Wolverines wrestler in 212. In other action, Lamar's Brooke Rude remained in the winner's bracket as of journal press time. She won her only match against APGC's Lainey Orant in 59 seconds. Ridgeview River Valley's Izzy Deeds won both matches that she won on 138 on Friday. First, she pinned Osage's Ainsley Dodd in 244, and then she won 11-0 in a major decision over AGWSR's Trinity Rogers. Dania Werner, 195, also won both her matches. Deeds and Werner were the only 2 Ridgeview River Valley wrestlers on the winner's bracket as of press time. Spencer still has 3 wrestlers alive in the winner's bracket. Top-seeded wrestler at 160, Morgan Griffin, received a bye in the first round. Then she pinned Crestwood's Nevaeh Howe in 141. Paris Dean pinned Decorah's Camille Wido in 1 minute 4 seconds at 170. And Olivia Huckfeldt received a bye at the 285 division. Next story on page C3, J.R. Bond becomes new Sioux City Bandits owner. The Sioux City Bandits announced Friday the transition of ownership from Bob Scott to J.R. Bond. Quoting here, "The decision to sell the Bandits was not an easy one, and it is a bittersweet day for me and my partners. We are proud to be the longest-running team under the same ownership group in all of indoor football," Scott said in a press release. "We could not have done it without the support of our great sponsors and fans. We also owe a debt of gratitude to our staff who are so devoted and work so hard for this franchise. We wish J.R. Bond the best of luck in this endeavor and will do everything to make this transition as smooth as possible." Bond currently owns multiple minor league franchises in the Midwest, and his sports philosophy revolves around his own children. He develops teams on a foundation of community involvement and entertainment. Going to women's college volleyball, Wichita State spoils USD opener. Wichita State spoiled South Dakota's COVID-delayed start to its volleyball season with a 25-20, 25-19, 26-24 sweep in a match played at Missouri State's Hammond Center Friday. Sammy Slaughter led a balanced USD attack with 10 kills, while Elizabeth Junk and Maddie Weidenfeld had 9 each. Wichita State hit at a 246 clip and got a match-high 13 kills from Richardson, Texas native Nicole Anderson. Madison Juergens had 27 assists and 11 digs, while Amy Adams and Elizabeth Junk had a dozen digs apiece for the Coyotes, who will face host Missouri State at 3 p.m. on Saturday. Another girls' volleyball news, Nebraska downs Indiana 3-0. Kayla Caffey didn't wait long to make an impact. In her first game at Nebraska, the Missouri transfer recorded a kill in the first point of the match. The 6-foot middle blocker finished with 6 kills and 3 blocks as the Huskers swept Indiana 25-22, 25-20, 25-17 on Friday evening. Going to girls' basketball, number 3 KP edges MMCRU. This Dayline Kingsley, the third-ranked Kingsley Pearson High School girls basketball team, had to battle back late Thursday night to keep its undefeated record intact. MMCRU led 26-22 at halftime and kept a lead after the third quarter at 43-48, but the Panthers, 16-0, rattled off 27 fourth-quarter points to beat the fifth-ranked Royals at 65-59. The Panthers had 3 players who scored in double figures. Mackenzie Goodwin led the Panthers with 18 points. Goodwin hit 6 field goals and made 6 free throws. Brooklyn Beery hit 3 three-pointers, and the Panthers senior ended up with 16 points. Delaney Eisminger scored 11 points. The Panthers didn't shoot as well as they normally have from the floor, 21 for 64, but they were effective from the free throw line. KP made 17 of 21 free throws. The Royals had 4 ladies who scored in double figures. Cora Eilish led MMCRU, who was 11-2 with 15 points. Eilish made 3 threes and 6 free throws. Emily Dreckman scored 13 points and also had 10 rebounds. Taylor Harpinall had 11 points, and she was 1 assist short of a double-double. Jalen Bork rounded out the top 4 in scoring with 10 points. Kingsley Pearson snapped the Royals' 8-game winning streak. The last loss for MMCRU came on December 11th to Unity Christian. Cool news from the local boy in town, Emming commits to ISU. SBL Jr. improved on physicality throughout 2020. This is by Zach James, Dateline Sergeant Bluff. Jacob Emming knew that the Iowa State University football team was the best fit for him, even when the Cyclones offered him a full-ride scholarship last spring. On Thursday, the Sergeant Bluff Luton High School junior committed to play for Matt Campbell and the Cyclones. Emming, listed at 6'2" and 205 pounds, on varsity bound, will play at the linebacker position once he arrives on the Ames campus in the fall of 2022. Emming is the first commitment of the 2022 recruiting class. Emming remembered the date of when the Cyclones gave him the offer, April 6th of 2020. Even though there has been interest from other programs, including Nebraska, Emming thought ISU was the best fit at the most opportune time. "I knew that them being the first offer, that would make a future impact on my overall decision," Emming said. "They've trusted me. They were one of the first ones there for me, no matter what, and they would always be in the race. I really felt Ames was the place for me to go," Emming added. "At the end of the day, my relationships with the coaches were always really good. They're continuing to build the program every day. I just wanted to be the first one to get in to lead the recruiting class and see what I can do. Campbell called Emming on Monday night through Zoom, and Emming asked for the Iowa State football coach some final questions. Emming liked what he heard, and that's when he knew the Cyclones were the right fit. If you've ever heard him talk, you can tell he's such an inspirational leader, and he knows what he wants, Emming said. He knows how to get it done. With him being such a good coach and such a good leader, it makes a lot of guys back him up. The Cyclones are coming off their best season in program history. Iowa State completed its season with a win over Oregon in the Fiesta Bowl, and it ended up with a 9-3 record. ISU finished 9th in the final Associated Press poll. Emming knew receiving his offers was a special moment. He knew that he was a talented football player, but he wasn't sure how high up a level he could climb. Once Iowa State started to recruit Emming, that's when he noticed how much potential he saw in himself. Emming thought he played well as a sophomore, but not one that he thought stood out for a program like Iowa State. Sure, he expected to get some looks, but nothing to that caliber. As a sophomore, Emming had 46 tackles, which was third behind Spencer Clean with 58.5 and Corey Bates at 58. Emming was Daniel Wright's third go-to receiver. Emming was third as a sophomore with 47 catches for 542 yards and 7 touchdowns. You hardly see guys from the Sioux City area go to these major Power 5 colleges, Emming said. It was a really special moment to know that I was on that kind of level. Emming then got heavier and stronger going into the 2020 football season. Emming felt more athletic and physical. Emming recorded 49.5 total tackles this past year, a team high. He had 32 total sacks and 7.5 sacks. Offensively, Emming led the Warriors with 7 receiving touchdowns. He caught 30 passes from quarterback Tyler Smith for 502 yards. Emming also carried the ball 9 times for 75 yards and scored twice. Warriors coach Justin Smith noticed how much more physical Emming played too. He was a man among boys out there in a lot of situations, Justin Smith said. I think he can still get a lot more physical this year as far as that goes. I would say that the largest improvement he made from his sophomore year to his junior. I think Jacob fits Iowa State's defensive system pretty well, Justin Smith added. He's a long, athletic linebacker who can really run sideline to sideline. Reading his keys and having a natural feel for the run game, those are all things I think he's improved on. It shows an inset picture on page C3 of Sergeant Bluff Luton's Jacob Emming running the ball as teammate Vince Lally blocked Spencer's Carter Perenshauser during a Sergeant Bluff Luton versus Spencer football action that was played Friday, October 9th in Sergeant Bluff. On the front page, it shows a picture of Heelan's Teddy Saltzman trying to shake a tackle by Sergeant Bluff Luton's Jacob Emming during the Bishop Heelan versus Sergeant Bluff Luton football game. That was played Friday, October 2nd in Sioux City. All right, it's time for Dear Abby. The first letter is Anxious RN in Alabama. It's titled Stressed Hospital Nurse Fears Consequences of Speaking Up. Dear Abby, I have been a nurse for 10 years and love taking care of my patients. I have worked at a mid-sized hospital for 2.5 years. Since I started working here, we have been assigned 6 or 7 patients at a time, although I was told when I was hired they were going to hire enough nurses to have a 4-to-1 ratio. It not only hasn't happened, but the administration keeps piling on paperwork for the nurses to complete. I have anxiety, and this is about to cause me to break. I love my job, and I don't want to leave. I just wish they would be more considerate of their nurses instead of making them feel like I do right now, which is wanting to find something else. Should I say something to my charge nurse about how I'm feeling? I'm afraid if I do, I'll be pushed out of this job. Adding to my anxiety is that my daughter now works at the same facility, and I'm afraid if I say anything, they will punish her. Please offer me your advice. Signed, Anxious RN in Alabama. Dear Anxious RN, because you feel the stress is becoming too much, I think you should address it with your charge nurse. It's the truth. Besides, because the pandemic has increased the workload on all medical caregivers, you are far from alone in feeling overwhelmed. When you speak up, do not couch it in terms of the fact that your employers haven't followed through on their promises. Do it strictly in terms of the effect it is having on you. I doubt you will be fired because experienced nurses are in such high demand right now. However, if you are let go and your daughter is questioned about it, all she should say is that the workload and the stress became too much for you. Speaking your truth should be no reflection on her. Next and last stories from Sleepless in Baltimore. Dear Abby, new neighbors moved into my apartment building about a month ago. I don't mind that sometimes I hear their kids. I don't mind that sometimes I hear the adults. But their alarm clock wakes me up every morning at 6 a.m. It's loud, and I'm guessing it's up against the adjoining wall. Normally, I sleep until 8. I work from home, and I'm usually up until 1 a.m. or so. I'm a night owl, and I simply can't go to sleep any earlier. It's impossible to sleep through their alarm. It has been weeks. I am afraid if I complain, they will call me a racist since I am white and they are black. But it's not a race thing. It's a sleep thing. What should I do? Signed, Sleepless in Baltimore. Dear Sleepless, write a polite note to the new neighbors and introduce yourself. Explain the problem you are experiencing and ask if they can help you by either moving their alarm clock to a different part of their bedroom or adjusting the ring to make it softer. It should be as simple as placing their clock on a soft surface like a towel. If they are unwilling to cooperate, as a last result, try earplugs and talk to the building manager about the noise problem. Taking one last look at the weather today, cloudy with a chance of afternoon snow showers, a high of 29. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a little snow, a low of 21, and a thick cloud cover tomorrow. Snow at night, a high of 29 for Sunday, a low 17 on Sunday night, and 24 for the high on Monday under cloudy skies. Cloudy Monday night, a low of 10 degrees. Tuesday, looks like cloudy again, and 25. Tuesday night, 16 for the low, a little bit warmer on Wednesday, cloudy, and maybe a morning flurry, and a high of 31. That does it for reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, January 23rd, 2021. For the last hour, the stories have been selected and read by me, John Reef. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions, you can call 877-404-4747. We thank you for listening to IRIS, your radio reading service.